Okay, we're beginning on the top of Lamed Aleph. Lamed Aleph by the two dots. The Gemara begins, Ze Omer Shalavutai, Ze Omer Shalavutai. The Bach here has an alternate girsa, but it says, Ze Omer Shalavutai, Vechaltei Shnei Chazaka, Ze Omer Shalavutai. So the question is whether they're making a statement simply that it belonged to my forefathers, the other one saying belonged to my forefathers, or they're also adding in the additional piece of information that he ate it, Shnei Chazaka. Aiti Sade Davatehi. This one brought evidence to the fact that it belonged to his family or his forefathers. Va Aiti Sade Da'achle Shnei Chazaka. And the other one brings evidence to the fact that he was there for the requisite number of years to establish Shnei Chazaka for 3 years. So you have both of them making a claim that it was owned by their forefathers. So they have the Ta'ana. One of them, in addition to that Ta'ana, also says I was there Shnei Chazaka and brings evidence to the fact that he was there Shnei Chazaka. Amar Rabba, Malo Lishaker. What's the point of lying over here? Ibai Amale, if he wanted to, he could say, Minach Zamanta, I purchased it from you, Va'achaltei Shnei Chazaka, and I ate it the years of the Chazaka. So Rabba says that this individual should be believed through a Migo, because he had a better claim that he could have made over here, which is to say, simply, I bought it from you, and now I was there for the requisite number of years to establish a chazaka. So if he was going to lie, that would have solved all of his problems, because now he's not even contradicting what the other person said. The other person said, it belonged to my forefathers, and he is corroborating that and saying, yes, it did. But I purchased it from you now, and now I've been here, Shnei Chazaka. The fact that he goes ahead and doesn't do that and says, oh, it belonged to my forefathers, and I've been here, Shnei Chazaka, should make him believable because of the alternative that he could have said. If he wanted to lie, he had a better claim or a better lie to present. Amar Le Abaye, Abaye says back to his Rebbe, Rabbo, Mali de Shaker, B'makom Edim, Lo Amrinan. Mali de Shaker doesn't work when you're going up against Edim, because you have a problem here, which is, Edim machshim et dvarav. You have Edim who are contradicting that which he says, who would say that, deshelavotav didachi, it belonged to the other person's forefathers. So you can't say, all of a sudden now, Migo, he had a better lie, he could have said something else. The problem with saying something else is that he's being contradicted. Each one of them made an independent claim here that it belonged to their forefathers. And one of them said, I was also here, Shnei Chazaka. Now, if the Edim come along and say it belonged to the other person's forefathers, you've never explained how it got from the other person's forefathers to you. I mean, that's what's missing. The missing link here, which is what Rabba claims is Mali L'Shaker, is the fact that you could have said, I bought it, and that's what brought it over to my side. He never made that claim, so now, how did it get to you if you have Edim saying it belonged to the other one's forefathers? So Rabba says he could have lied, so we should believe him. Abaye says the other Edim make it impossible for him to lie. Mali Shaker b'makom Edim, you have a difficulty now in saying that I could have lied, I could have said something else, because you have something preventing you from saying that something else, and that is the Edim. And that's what the Rashbam says, Shor Edim machshim et dvarav, shomrim d'shalavutav d'idachi, because they are contradicting what he is saying. V'gam ha'chazaka inu klum. Chazaka is no longer valuable. Shreini ma ta'ana. It doesn't have a claim. Kim ta'anat sheker. The only claim he has is a false claim. And therefore, aloha ki Abaye. Aloha here is like Abaye. Shari Rabba hodelo kumucha chvazil. We're going to see Rabba agrees to him, or is going to admit that his point is well taken over here. According to the Rashbam, the Mali the Shaker, b'makom Edim, the problem is that the Edim are contradicting your statement. And in contradicting your statement no longer holds water. If your statement doesn't hold water, what is your claim to the property? You don't have a claim to the property, your chazaka no longer carries any weight. Chazaka can only carry weight if you have a claim as to how you came into possession of the property. Here, your claim that is how you came into the possession of the property is being contradicted by the Edim, who suggests that it belonged to this other person's forefathers. You only have Edim about the Shnei Chazaka, but that makes you a squatter. It doesn't mean that you have rights to it. The Shnei Chazaka over here don't do anything for you. That's the way that the Rashbam formulates it. Tosfot over here asks, Teima l'ashba, amai havi b'makom Edim. Why do you have to say over here that it is, Mali l'shaker b'makom Edim? Neima, Shelavutav Aita Yom Echad. If he says that it belonged to his forefathers for one day, V'nemar Shlacha Me'avutav. And then he could say that they purchased it from the forefathers. Meaning that the transaction was between the forefathers, and I inherited it from them, and I inherited it after they were there for one day. Because we would speak up on behalf of an inheritor to suggest that his forefathers had it for a day. As long as he can bring evidence to the fact that they were in that property for a day, he can be Yoreshit. He doesn't have to explain how it got from the other person's forefathers to his forefathers. We will say on his behalf, they bought it. And then he could keep it. Why is it amigo b'makom edim over here? That's what the Rosh Mishantz is asking on this Gemara. Where is the amigo b'makom edim, since the whole story could be told in a manner where there's no contradiction between what he is saying and what the edim are saying? Both sets of edim could be correct. The first set of edim said it belonged to the other person's forefathers. He says, I was there shnei chazaka. And we just say, can prove that his forefathers were there for one day, then he has a very valid claim. We say that the forefathers sold it to each other, and then he was there afterwards, shnei chazaka, and he can keep it. So, v'omer Rabbeinu Yitzchak, the shelavutai mashma, shaita me'olam shelavutai, v'lo shelachua ad shifaresh b'dvarav. So here's to answer your question, that we do not say that it belonged to my forefathers because they bought it from your forefathers. Because when you make a claim that it belonged to my forefathers, that means that it was there forever. That means that it's a family property that's been there for ages. Doesn't mean that they all of a sudden were there for one day. And therefore, you can't make this claim that the whole story played out or panned out in this manner. But you do see from the Balei Tosafot is that if there was any edut, if there was any testimony to the fact that this individual's forefathers were in the property for any amount of time, then he would be believed over here. And he would get the property, because then he would be deemed a Yoresh, and if he's deemed a Yoresh, he gets to keep the property. So the Rashbam claims over here that you've lost your Tana, and the Chazaka without a Tana is nothing. And therefore here, Migo B'makom Edim, the Edim have in one sense taken away your claim, and in taking away your claim, you have nothing left. The Chazaka has no standing independently. And therefore, you can't do anything at this point because you have no ta'ana left. On the other hand, the way that the Rabbeinu Chananel and others term it is that here you have competing sets of evidence. You have a deem testifying to one fact, and you have this individual who's going to be believed because of a migo. And what we say is that the migo is not strong enough to offset or to nullify the power of the deem that are there. Yes, this person could have changed his testimony. Yes, this person could have lied and have given a better lie, but now we have edim that are saying something to the contrary. So even if we give him the nemanut through the migo, that's not strong enough to overcome the testimony of the edim on the other side. But what does come out of that, and we noted this in the Balei Tosafot, is that if he had edut of any sort that his forefathers were there for at least a day, that would be strong enough to then give him a migo to overcome the other edim. Because at that point, we would start to intervene on his behalf, to be toin on his behalf, because he's then a yoresh. And if he can bring evidence to the fact that his forefathers had it for any moment at a time, then we will be toin on his behalf that his forefathers bought it from this other individual's forefathers. And that would then not contradict the testimony of the edim. Given that, then he would be believed by amigo, because now we have a way to reinterpret his words. But without those edim, we will not reinterpret his words to say that, oh, he could have said that my forefathers bought it from your forefathers, and therefore I should be believed over here. We will not intervene on his behalf to change his testimony to make him believable and not in contradiction with the edim. And that's what it means. There's no migo b'makom edim. Although many Rishonim point out that might be the fundamental machloki between Rabbi and Abaye over here as to whether we allow him to amend, or do we suggest that he can amend his testimony in this type of case? In a situation in which it's the edim that are forcing or causing him to amend the statement, do we still say that that is amigo? Abai says it's not amigo anymore. He was compelled to change his testimony to conform to the position of the edim, or not to contradict the edim. That's not called amigo by which you are believed. The other hand, Rabba says it's fine. He just amends his testimony. He's not lying, he's just simply amending it so now it fits in with the testimony of the edim. That's still considered to be a migo, and therefore he would be believed over here, despite the fact that there are edim. Hadar amarle. So then he said to him, in davatachi v'zavanta minach or v'zavanta minayu. It's not clear what the girsa is over here, but he changes his tune. So the first claims were, one individual says it belonged to my forefathers, and I ate it for the 3 years. The other one says it belonged to my forefathers. We get a deem for the second one that it belonged to his forefathers, and we get a deem for the first one that he was there for the 3 years. So now we have a problem because we have a migo b'mukum edim, and we wouldn't believe him. So then he changes his tune a little bit and says, in, you're right, davatachi, it did belong to your forefathers, v'zavanta minach. The way that the Gersa reads over here, and you can see that in the Rabbeinu Gershom, which is, uminach zavinta, I purchased it from you. On the other hand, the Gersa that the Bach has over here is v'zavanta minayu, which is v'kaneitia mi'avutecha, I bought it from your forefathers. So in this case, what he's doing is saying, Enochanami, what the Edim are saying about your forefathers being in this property is correct. Just, there's a little change over here. I purchased it from them, or I purchased it from you. So they are right, but the status changed because of this purchase. V'hai d'amri lach, wait a minute, didn't you say before, davatai, that you said it belonged to your forefathers? Now you're saying it didn't belong to your forefathers. You purchased it from me, or you purchased it from my forefathers. That means it didn't belong to your forefathers. Why did you say that? The Samech Allah Kedavatai. I was reliant on it as if it was a family property. I had such a good grip on it, legally, that I felt it was as if it was a family property that's been there forever. So I used it not as a terminology to describe the yichus of the property, but rather as an expression of saying that the property to me is like a family property, solidly and legally in my possession, like as if it was a family property. Toin, v'chozer v'toin, o ein toin v'chozer v'toin. Is a person given permission to amend their position or their statement in such a manner? As the Rashbam lays out over here, we don't allow you to change your statement to the point where it contradicts the first statement. But the question is, whether we allow you to amend the statement where you make a slight adjustment in the statement that then makes everything work. So you haven't changed your statement completely. You're saying the same thing you said before. You're just giving us a new twist or interpretation of what you said before. Is that allowed? Is a person allowed to do such a thing and to adjust or amend his testimony in such a manner, and we will believe him? Ulamar Toin v'chozer v'toin. Ula says you have a right to make such an adjustment in your testimony, and we won't consider it that you're perjuring yourself. We simply will view this as an explanation as to what you said before. You're redefining the terms for us, or you misunderstood me in the first place. Nar dayamri ain't toin v'chozer v'toin. You don't have a right to do this. Once you've made your statement is binding, and we don't allow you now to give interpretations to the statement that makes it that your claim is a better claim. Umode Ula. Ula will agree to the position of the Nardai. In a case where he says it belongs to my forefathers and not your forefathers, then he can't adjust it. Because in that case, when he makes the adjustment, he's completely contradicting that which he said before. If he had simply said it belonged to my forefathers, then he can reinterpret it the way we just saw, which is to say, it was as if it was my forefathers. I felt so secure in the land that it was like my forefathers. But if he comes along and says in the first place, it was my forefathers and not your forefathers, and then after he says, you know what, I really bought it from your forefathers, or my forefathers bought it from your forefathers, well then what happened to the lo shel avotecha part of it, where he said it didn't belong to your forefathers? Now he's changing that completely. He's completely contradicting that which he said before. There, Ula agrees, they know chotoin v'chozer v'toin. You don't have a right to amend your statement in that case. In addition, Ula agrees that you don't have a right to change your testimony in a case where he testified in Beit Din, velo ta'an, and then he did not adjust the testimony. And after he left Beit Din, he thinks about it, comes back to Beit Din and says, I want to change or amend what I said. We do not let him make that emendation. My taima, ta'anate agamrei. He got advice. Some lawyers got a hold of him. And they taught him what to say, and that's why he went back to court to change his testimony. We want it to be, in a sense, a pure testimony, whereby he's explaining to us what he meant. Not that someone else taught him how to adjust his testimony so now that it won't be problematic. So we're looking or trying to see that he's telling the truth. One piece of evidence is that he does it on the spot. He explains to us what he meant on the spot, makes that adjustment. If he leaves Beit Din and comes back, that sounds like there's influences from the outside that are helping him to change his mind, quote-unquote, about what he said before without altering his testimony completely. So in those two cases, Ula agrees that we do not allow you to amend your testimony. Umodu Naradai, on the other side of the ledger, did Naradai agree, Heichid Amrale Shelavutai, Shulach Chumi Avutecha, that if he said that it was my forefathers that purchased it from your forefathers, the Choser Vitoein. In that case, he can go back and amend his position, because over there, he's not changing his words at all. He's not changing what he said originally. He's just giving more explanation to it. He's not like in the previous case where we say it's some sort of expression that it belonged to my forefathers. Here he's saying it literally belonged to my forefathers, but it came into their possession through your forefathers. And in doing that, he has not changed his testimony whatsoever. He said it belonged to my forefathers, and he's still saying it belonged to my forefathers. He's just adding on the fact that his forefathers got it from your forefathers. That already is not a change in the testimony, simply a little addition to the testimony. There, the Naradai agree you can even amend the testimony because there's no reinterpretation that's going on. They're simply adding more information to the claim. The Rabbeinu Gershom says that when it says Modeh Naradai, Adamalei Shalavutai Shalachu Me'avutecha, I belong to my forefathers that bought it from your forefathers, the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom has the gear says, you can see the Rabbeinu Gershom, that he says that that was the original claim, that he says, my forefathers bought it from your forefathers, and the emendation over here is simply that he bought it from the forefathers, and he said it's as if my forefathers bought it from your forefathers, as opposed to the way the Rashi was explaining it, which is originally just said that it belonged to my forefathers, and the emendation was that it belonged to my forefathers because they bought it from your forefathers. But in both those situations, it's considered not to be any change or emendation of the statement. It's simply an expansion on what that which was said before. And then the Rashi points out, he's just adding to his words because the chazaka yisheishi matana, he has a chazaka now and he has a tana, the malo l'shaker, and here you can put in the migo of why is it worth him lying and saying that his forefathers bought it from your forefathers? Because he could have just said, I bought it from you, and I was there with the chazaka, and he would have kept the property. So now the fact that he just says, my forefathers bought it from your forefathers, that addition or that extra piece of information doesn't change anything. It still remains that he has a claim, he has a chazaka, and that gives him the right to stay in the property. And if he's going to lie, he just said, I bought it myself from you. He shouldn't say, my forefathers bought it from your forefathers. So that additional information is only enhancing, not something that's changing his testimony in any way. Again, as we noted, this is only in a case where he has no testimony to the fact that his forefathers were in the property. Because if he had that piece of testimony, then he wouldn't need any other claim besides the fact that he was an inheritor from his forefathers, about whom he has evidence that they were in this property at least for one day. In addition, the Naradai agree that he can amend his statement in the following case, where they were talking outside of Beit Din. They are asking him, why do you think this is yours? And he gave certain reasons for it. Velotan. And in that case, he didn't give his claim or his trump card. Va'atala Beidina. And then he shows up in Beit Din, Vitan, and then he makes this claim, the Choser Vitoein. There he can change his mind. My taima. Avidinish, delo migale itanate. People have a tendency not to reveal their trump card or to reveal what they're going to say in Beit Din. Elo the Beit Din. Except when they get there. They don't want the other side getting the claim that he's going to make so that they can come up with defenses to that claim. Still true today that when litigators go to court, they don't reveal all of their positions. Because once you reveal your positions, it gives the other side time to prepare a defense against those positions. So over here, since they were outside the context of Beit Din, he wasn't compelled or didn't feel it was necessary to tell them what he was going to say. or even give him the right information. He could change his mind, he could do whatever he wants once he walks into Beit Din, because he is under no obligation when he was outside of Beit Din. Now the Rashbam clarifies that is only true when we're talking about claims that he's going to make in Beit Din. On the other hand, if he makes admissions outside of Beit Din, for instance, yes, I do owe you that money, that's a full-fledged admission. He can't say, oh, when it comes into Beit Din, I was just joking around then. No, that's a full-fledged admission. There's no reason when you're admitting to something outside of court that you come to court and then deny that. That has nothing to do with your claim. That has to do with your obligations. And then if you obligate yourself outside of Beit Din, and they're edim to the fact that you admitted to owing the money, that is binding. You can't change your mind when you come into Beit Din. The only thing we're allowing you to change your mind over here is the ta'ana, is the claim that you had the right to make such a claim. You didn't reveal all the claims that you were going to make. In that case, we allow you to adjust it. And the Rashbam says here that even if it's a complete change in the testimony, it's a complete denial of that which he said before, or a contradiction to what he said before, that is permitted in this case because that was all done outside the context of Beit Din. And outside the context of Beit Din, it has no binding force in terms of what you said. Although there are those that argue on the Rashbam and say that if it's a complete contradiction to that which you said before, that you can't do. What you can do is give little pieces of information and then expand on them or amend them in Beit Din. What you can't do is completely contradict your statement from before. The Rashbam here believes that you are allowed to do that because outside of Beit Din is meaningless. The Baal Tosafot over here asks an interesting case. He says, did Naradai agree here? If you just are mosif onto something, that it's fine. It says, Misfeka the Ri, Teichan the Nofik the Brai. What happens if he went outside of Beit Din, Bechazar, and then he came back? Va'ata the Beit Din, Imatza the Meimarachi. When he came back to Beit Din, he's allowed to do this. So in essence, Tosafot says, what happens if I combine the two situations? Ulo agreed in the situation where you leave Beit Din that you don't have a right to come back and amend your statement. The Nadai agree in a case where you're not amending your statement, simply adding on to your statement, that you're allowed to amend your statement. So now, if I take both of those together, what would be the din? In a case where he comes and testifies in Beit Din, then leaves. When he comes back, he does not amend his testimony. He simply adds on additional facts at the end of the statement. So in that case, do we say because he left Beit Din that it's problematic to amend his testimony? Or do we say because he's not changing his testimony whatsoever, he's just simply adding on facts, that that's not a problem because nobody has to teach him that information. It's not sneaky or sly or cunning that he left and someone's teaching him how to amend it. It simply is just adding on information. So if you put those two pieces of information together, are you then allowed to amend your statement? So the Ri asks the question without giving any answer to it. Whereas the Rashi thinks in this case that we would consider it to be problematic once you leave Beit Din, that we start to worry about the individual getting advice or being more cunning about what he's doing because he's left Beit Din, and therefore we would not accept testimony in this case, although Tosafot leaves it as a safek. Now the Gemara continues and says, Amar Meimar. Meimar says, Ana Narada, Ano. I am a Narada, Besvirle, and I hold the Toein v'chozer v'toein. Even though I'm a Narada, and supposedly the Narada argue on this point, nevertheless, I believe like Ula that you are Toein v'chozer v'toein. V'hilchata, and the law is Toein v'chozer v'toein, that you have a right to amend your statement like Ula said, in cases or in situations where you are giving explanation or reinterpreting that which you said before, where there's a slight change in what you said before. If it's a complete contradiction to that which you said before, that we do not allow. If it is only an addition to that which you said before, then everybody allows that. The only question was about the case where you're making this emendation or slight change in the nuance or explanation of what you're saying. Is that permissible? And we pass them like Ula. And Amemar says, despite the fact I'm Narada, that I believe like Ula that the halacha is that you do have a right to make such an emendation. Now it seems from here that the machloket about Toein v'chozer v'toein is only in a case where the edim are forcing the emendation of his statement. What happens in a situation is when he makes the emendation independently, without being compelled by the testimony of the edim to adjust his testimony. Over there, do we believe him, even if he's contradicting the first statement? So there are those that say that, yes, he has a right to change his ta'ana, even if it completely contradicts his first ta'ana, because he wasn't compelled to change it. He changed it of his own volition. No edim, no evidence was brought to the contrary. And now he's just changing it, even though it completely contradicts what he said before. We're okay with that. Others say, no, that once you've made a statement, you have to be bound by that statement. You can make adjustments to that statement, but you can't completely contradict that statement. What we will allow you to do is give other options or other reasons to say that you are patur, which happens in many cases today as well, which is that the lawyers will present, if you want to say this, we should be patur because of this. If you want to say this, we'll be patur. And they give numerous different arguments why the individual should be patur. That over here we will allow, even according to those that say you can't contradict yourself when there are no edim, but still we will allow you to bring in competing claims, as long as all of those claims are of the same vein, which is to make you patur. What we won't allow you to do is come in and say at first something that would make you chayav, and then change your mind to make it into be patur. That we won't allow, because that's complete contradiction or change in what you said, and that, even without edim, we won't allow you to do in Beit Din. So again here, they both argue that it belonged to their forefathers. The Bach adds in that each one of them also say, not only do it belong to my forefathers, but I also was there for 3 years. Both of them make that claim. One of them brings a dim that it belonged to his forefathers, and he was there for the requisite 3 years. And the other one only brings evidence or a dim to the fact that he was there for 3 years. Amar Rav Nachman, Oki Achila Lebahadi Achila. Well, you have offsetting claims with regards to the 3 years, so we'll offset them against each other. And then what's left over? The testimony that it belonged to the forefather of this individual. So if we say that the two statements, each one of them bring evidence that they ate it or they were there for 3 years, those are offsetting claims, and we can't make any decision about that. So we'll wipe those out. They'll be as if they don't exist. And then what's left over is that there's one claimant who has edim, that it belonged to his forefathers, and that will trump. That will be the deciding factor over here. Amalei Rava, Rava says, ha'edut mukheshiti. What are you talking about? This is contradictory edim. One set of edim is clearly lying over here, or is problematic. They're both testifying about something that can't be true. Now, that's not necessarily true, because they could be speaking about different 3 years. So as the Rashbam clarifies over here, they're speaking about the exact same 3 years. It has to be, otherwise there's no contradiction in their testimony. It has to be that they're both testifying that each of these individuals was there during the same 3 years. Then, for certain, one of the set of Edim are lying, because they both couldn't have been there for those 3 years. Given that, we would suggest, or what Rava is suggesting is, we should discard the Edut completely. How can you believe these Edim if one set of Edim is definitely lying? We have a safek here. We don't know which set is lying. So if you say, oh, well, let's drop away the things that they're arguing about, and you have the testimony about the forefathers left. Well, you can't do that, because someone's lying over here. Once we've tagged them as Edim that could be lying, why would we allow the remainder of their testimony to be used? There's a very good possibility that these are Edim that are lying, and therefore you can't believe not only what is mukheshet, what is contradicted, you can't even believe what they said that it is not contradicted. So the machloket between them seems to be, or revolve around, what do you do when you have Edim about which we have a safek? We know one set of Edim is definitely lying. We just don't know which set of Edim it is. Rava says both of their testimonies are gone because we can't trust them. We don't know which one to trust or not trust. Therefore, we wipe out, they're completely wiped out. Rav Nachman says that people have a chezkat kashrut, that when it comes to individuals, they have a chazaka that they tell the truth until proven otherwise. Over here, we only have a safek. We're not certain as to which set of Edim are lying over here. Given that, we're not going to automatically assume that they are lying or they're no longer trustworthy unless we have evidence that proves to us with certainty that they were lying edim. Therefore, we can trust the testimony of the ones that has that extra piece of information. Now, the Baal Tosafot asks a number of questions with regards to Rava's position. Rava is also famous for his position with regards to edim zomimim, where there is a machloket between Abai and Rava with regards to ed zomim or edim zomimim. Are they psulim limafreya? When they are found to be edim zomimim, does that then ruin their ability to testify even retroactively? And whatever they said from here all the way back was considered to be lies? Or do we say mikan ala abba? Then only prospectively we consider them to be edim zomimim. Everything they said before is left intact. From here to forward, they won't be believed about anything. Rava is of the position that ed zomim is mikan ula abba. That it's from here to forward that you are considered to be problematic. So Tosfot says over here, given Rava's position, why is Rava worried about what they said before? We come along, now you have the contradictory edut, and if you believe that, that causes problems in their nemanut, that should only be prospectively causing them a problem in their nemanut. It should not affect what they've testified about already. Here, they testified already that the forefathers were in the property. That piece of testimony should stand because we've only dismissed their trustworthiness going forward. We do not look backwards in this. Tosva gives a number of answers over here, one of which is, Meshum Deidzonim Chidushu. In the machlok between Abai and Rava about Eidim Zolimim is, the Gemara gives two reasons behind Rava's position. One reason behind his position is that Eidzonim Chidushu. Eidzonim is a Chidush that the second Eidim are believed more than the first Eidim. That's a Chidush. And therefore, if you have a Chidush, you only Chidusho. Whatever the Chidush is, that's what you take, not more than that. On the other hand, there is another reason brought, which is, like Seda de Lukuchot. That we don't want to affect purchasers beforehand who now have all of their contracts and all of their transactions annulled because of this problem. So if you say that it's because of a chidush, then it's easy to understand here. Rava's statement there by Eid Zomim is unique to Eidim Zomimim, which is not true over here where you have Eidut Mechucheshet. Over here, there's no reason to say it's a chidush. Given that, you can explain the difference between them is that Eid Zomim is a unique institution. And that's why he says mikan alaba, but it's not applicable over here. On the other hand, if you believe in the other reason behind Rava's position, it should be equally applicable over here. And so therefore, the Rivani Rad Lo Dami, that over there, it's not comparable. He says that case over there, you can separate between the testimonies. That's what you were saying, that all of those were independent testimonies. Since they were independent testimonies, I can say mikan alaba. I can separate between what is prospective versus what they testified about already. Over here, their testimony is a single testimony, which is, it was his forefathers, and he was there for 3 years. That testimony is a unit of testimony. You really can't separate the two, because without one part of the testimony, the other part of the testimony is not helpful. So him being there 3 years isn't helpful unless there's some reason he was there for the 3 years, which is that it belonged to his forefathers. And so therefore, their testimony is viewed as a block or a unit. Given that, if we wipe out a part of it, we're going to wipe out the entirety of this statement. So in addition to that, there are those Rishonim, and the Bayit Tosafot ask on the Amud Bet, that why don't we say Pagin and Dibura? Rava is of the position that we bifurcate a person's statement. If a person comes into court and gives two statements, one of those statements is a good statement, the other statement is no good. We are Pagin and Dibura. We split, we bifurcate a statement, we accept the statement that is valid, and we let go of the statement that's not valid. Why don't you say the same thing over here? Pagin and Dibura of these Eidim. Say the statement that's Mukheshet, we'll let go. The statement that is not Mukheshet, we will accept. So here again, the Rishonim explain that Pagin and Dibura is only said when there's a technicality that invalidates his statement. So for instance, the case that the Gemara brings in many instances is where Ein Adam Mitzim Atzmo Rasha. The person testifies that he and another person engaged in some illegal act. He cannot testify about himself. He cannot incriminate himself. So over there we say Pagin and Dibura, which is we don't believe him about himself, but we believe him about the other party. The reason we don't accept his testimony is a technicality. It's not because we believe he is lying. It's because there's a technicality under the law that you can't incriminate yourself. Or it can be a technicality under the law that you are a relative. Something that causes your testimony to be invalidated. Not because you're not telling the truth, but because there's a technicality that invalidates there. There we say, Pagin and Dibura. There we say, we'll bifurcate your statement, drop the statement that is invalid, keep the statement that's valid. Where we don't say, Pagin and Dibura, is in a situation like this, where you're found to be lying, or you're Edut Mukheshet. In that case, we cannot say, Pagin and Dibura, because here, the underlying problem is not a technicality, it's an underlying problem of lying or trust. Once you've done that, we can't believe you about anything. We can't say Pagin and Dibura, oh, you lied about this, but we're going to believe you about that. That is not Pagin and Dibura. Pagin and Dibura is, we believe you about both statements, but we can't accept one of the statements because there's a technical problem. So that's how it differentiates from Pagin and Dibura, which Rava supports in other places. versus over here where we won't say pagin and dibura. Amalei, so Rav Nachman says back to him, nehiti tkachesh b'achilata, b'avata mi tkachesh. So Rav Nachman says back to Rava, I agree with you that there is a contradiction with regards to the achila portion of it. With regards to the avata part of it, the forefathers part, nobody's disagreeing with it. So therefore we'll accept, we'll again bifurcate the testimony and say the part that we're not believed about, we let it go. The part that is independent, then we will accept that part. Lema Rava Rav Nachman pluk to the Rav Huna Rav Chista Gamivlege. Let us say that Rava and Rav Nachman are arguing the same machloket Rav Huna and Rav Chista have. Ditmar. We have a machloket amoraim. Bet kite edim amachishot zo et zo. You have two sets of edim that contradict each other. Am Rav Huna, zo ba bifnei atzma umeida, zo ba bifnei atzma umeida. That they do not lose their trustworthiness. And in another case, or in another situation, they could come and testify independently. What he says is, outside of this context, each one of them could go independently and testify, because we have a safek as to which one of them is lying. They have a chazaka of being neman, of being trustworthy. In other cases, they can go testify. What they can't do, as the Rashbam points out, is take one aid from each group and get together in a testimony. Because then, for sure, we have a problem. Which is that, if you have Reuben and Shimon, and Levi and Yehuda, Reuben and Shimon say A, Levi and Yehuda say B, and they're contradicting each other. If they go into other testimonies, then Reuben and Shimon can testify in other cases, and Levi and Yehuda can go testify in other cases, because we don't know which one is lying, we have a safek, and we assume that both of them are telling the truth then. But, if you take one member from the first kat, for instance, Reuben from the first kat, and Levi from the second kat, and they together go testify somewhere else, that edut would be problematic, even according to Rav Huna, because there you clearly have one of two edim that was lying. When we put them together, we're now certain that we have a party from one of the two sets that was definitely lying, because one of them was lying, and now you have them together, there's no way that you have a good set of edim over here. Rav Chista Amar, Ba'adei Sadei Shakrei Lomeli. Chista says, what do we need these lying edim for? And in essence, we have a safek, and through that safek, we now deem them both to be lying sets of edim. Tosfot over here asks, why don't we believe the second set of edim that come in these situations, bimigo? Because the second set of edim could have come along and be mezim. They could have said imanu aitim about the first edim. If they wanted to lie, they could have done a much better job at lying and then incriminated the first edim, and that would have held their testimony in place. Tosfot says that's not a strong migo because the edim are afraid to be mezim the first edim because some other set of edim can come along and say imanu aitim and cause them to be then made into edim zomimim. So that's not a path that they would take. That's not a viable mali l'shaker option that they would have taken if they were going to lie because it's too risky. But then he says, why don't we say that there's a migo that the second set of edim could have just testified about the first edim that they are gazlanim, that they were thieves or they were somehow pasuli edut. If they're going to lie, why come and contradict their testimony? Simply come along and undermine the reputation of the edim. Given that migo, why don't we believe the second set of edim over the first set of edim? So Stosova gives two answers to the question, the first of which is that we don't a migo b'makom edim, that the other testimony of the other edim makes it that this is a migo b'makom edim, and therefore we don't say migo b'makom edim, and that's why we do not give the second set of edim this nemanut because of the migo. Or the reed gives a bigger chiddush, which is you only say migo when you're dealing with a single person. A single person can decide whether to lie in this way or to lie in that way. As soon as you enter in more than one party, if they're going to then collude to do something, it's much harder than to argue that if they wanted to lie, they would have lied this way. Because collusion, and as you expand the number of edim, becomes much harder if you're going to say we're going to lie this way or lie that way. It's much more difficult, and therefore we don't give them the benefit of the doubt that they could have done this. Since they didn't do this, we should believe them over here. The reason why they might not have done that is because it's very hard to get both of them on the same page to lie in that manner. And so therefore it's not really a viable option in terms of amigo as to why we would believe them in this situation. So Leima Rav Nachman Dabar Ki Rav Huna. Let us say Rav Nachman is like Rav Huna, who says that we are able to split up the edut and say that despite the fact that we know there's some problem in their edut, whatever else they testify about, they still will be trustworthy with regards to that. And Rav holds like Rav Chista that these lying edim, once they are found to be lying, they lose all their trustworthiness, Even though we don't know which side is lying. It's a safek, but given the safek, we're not going to trust them in any other situation. So Gemara says, according to Rav Chista, nobody argues. That everybody agrees. According to Rav Chista, that once you have edim that are mukhashot, they're out of the picture, they're not trustworthy. Both sets are out of the picture, and Rav Nachman and Rava would agree to that. Ki plige alibi de Rav Huna. They're arguing within the position of Rav Huna. Rav Nachman ka Rav Huna. Rav Nachman is simply like Rav Huna, which says that we let whatever is mukheshet go, and then the remainder of their testimonies or any other independent testimonies are believed. Rava amar adkan lo kamar Rav Huna elele dut acheret. That's only true with regards to other testimony. Aval de oto edut lo. With regards to that particular edut, we don't believe them. So yes, Rav Huna says that even though there's a safek as to which set of edim here are lying, and we will trust them in other cases because we just don't know who's lying, and therefore you retain your trustworthiness, that's only when you go to testify in another situation or another circumstance. With regards to this particular case, we know that one set is lying, and therefore we're not going to say, oh, we'll just drop the part of the testimony that you're lying about, the rest of it. Well, believe you, no. Since this is a testimony about a particular item, you are not trusted in this case whatsoever. You've been banned from this case at this point in time because we know there's some problem with one of your two testimonies. Therefore, we're going to dismiss both of your testimonies completely. In other cases, you come independently. You're considered to be trustworthy because we only have a safek about you. But within this case itself, we are not going to believe you at all. Hadar, aiti sade davatehi. After all this took place and all this argument went down, he brought edim that it belonged to his forefathers as well. So if you remember, until now, we had the edim testifying to one of them that it belonged to his forefathers, and he had shnei chazakah. The other one only had edim that it was shnei chazakah. Now he gets edim that it also belonged to his forefather. That means now that both sides have complete edut that is machish, that is contradictory. They both have the same evidence, and edim are testifying to the same information. So now it's a stalemate because we have the same information on both sides. Amar Rav Nachman, Anna Achtinei, Anan Maskinenle. We gave it up or we took it. We have to return it. The Ziluta de Beidina lo Chayshinan. We don't worry about the loss of reputation that will be suffered by the Beitin. So there are different ways to read this over here. Does Achtinei mean that you gave him rights to go down to the property? And the Lesalek Otel means now to remove him from the property. Or does Achtinei mean that you remove the property from him? And then the Lesalkei means now you're restoring the property to him. So is it referencing to the individual who you then put into the property or remove from the property? Or is it referring to the property that you remove from the individual and now restoring to the individual? For what it seems like from the Rashbam and others is that they gave the property to the one who had the testimony with the forefathers. Because according to Rav Nachman, that evidence trumps, and therefore you give him the property. Once the Edim showed up for the other side and said he also had evidence that it was his forefathers, we have to take it back and then restore it to what it was before. Before we had a safek, now we restore it to that sense of safek that we had before. So before it was a safek, then we paskin like one party, and we gave psak din in favor of one party. This new testimony comes, we change our mind, and we're going to retract the psak din. The ziluta de beit din is that beit din acted, and now retracted what they did. It looks bad for the beit din to have to change their psak din. Nevertheless, it makes it look like they're not trustworthy. But because we have new evidence, we say that we don't worry about the issue of the beit din's reputation. We want to restore it to the proper situation. The proper situation is that it was a safek. The way the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is it. So Amar Rav Nachman Ana Chetina Lahu De Aitim Yikara Sade Davotai VeNatlanu Nichsei Mihai Davi Muchzak Bu. We took it away from the person who was muchzak in the property and gave it to the individual who had testimony in favor of his forefathers. Now that he brought also testimony, we're going to have to take it away from him and return it to the other individual. So the difference in the case is that the Rashbam believes that it was a safek up front, and then we decided in that safek we gave a psak din, and then now we're retracting the psak din and putting it back into the category of safek. And then v'chol d'alim gavar, and then we would then be subject to the din of v'chol d'alim gavar because we don't know what to do with it. It's now a safek. And whoever has the better proofs or whoever stronger will win in that case. But the whole thing started as a safek, and then we gave a psak, and now we're retracting that psak and putting it back into the category of safek. The way the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is it was in the possession of one of the two parties. He had a chazaka. He was living in it. We threw him out of there in favor of the testimony that it said it belonged to the other guy's forefather. Now that we have testimony that evened it out, we're going to return it to the status quo. That status quo was that the individual was mukzak in it. So we're going to return the property to the person who was mukzak in the property originally. So that the difference between them is where was the starting point. Was the starting point that somebody had the property, and now we have evidence to move it from his possession. We lost that evidence. We're going to give it back to him. Or was the original problem that it was a safek? It didn't belong to either party. We gave up psak, and now we're going back to the original status of safek. So those are two different ways to read it. The Balei Tosafot say that what the Rashbam says, as well as what the Rabbeinu Gershom say, could both be true, and there's really no nafkamina between them. You could read the Gemara in either way. There's no normative difference between those two explanations of the Gemara. Although the Ramban does think that there is a nafkamina between these two positions, l'alocha, based on the Yerushalmi. Meidiv Rava Vitema Rabbi Zeira. Rava, and some say Rabbi Zeira, raise an issue with this statement of Rav Nachman that we don't worry about the reputation of the Beit Din. Shnaim omrim meit, u'shnaim omrim lo meit. Someone whose husband went overseas, and we don't know what happened to him. Two Edim show up and say that he passed away. Two Edim come and say that he's still alive. Shnaim omrim nitgasha, shnaim omrim lo nitgasha. Two of them say that she was divorced from him. Two say that she wasn't divorced from him. It's a case of Yibum. Is she obligated to perform Yibum or not? Well, that'll depend. If she wasn't divorced, she's chayevet in Yibum. If she was divorced, then there's no Yibum over here. Harizo lo tinasei. This woman cannot get married based on this testimony because it's contradictory testimony. And given the testimony that we have no evidence to one side or the other, and therefore she can't get married. V'im niseit, if she's already married, lo teitzei, then she does not divorce whomever she married. So she is not supposed to marry based on the evidence in front of us because there is a stira between the edim and we have no evidence. You have a safek. But if she does get married, in that case, we would not force her out of that marriage misafek. So if she ignores the edut and the safek that is here and goes ahead and gets married, we would not force them to separate. Balei Tosafot over here bring from the Gemara in Tekubot, that's only true when the woman marries one of the edim that testifies that the husband had passed away. Since both of them are certain to the fact that the husband has passed away, we can't then undermine their marriage misafek. But if they don't know, and this misafek, they decide to get married, then Beit Din would compel them to divorce, because what right do they have to live together when we don't know whether the husband has passed away or not? Rabbi Menachem, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Teitze. Menachem Yossi says, no, she's got to get divorced. Amar Rabbi Menachem Rabbi Yosei, Emetayani Omer Teitze. When do I say she has to get divorced? Bizman Shabbat Udim, V'achar Kach Niseit. When the Edim came, the contradictory Edim came first, and then she got married. Aval Niseit, if she first got married, V'achar Kach Bau Edim, and then the other Edim came, Harizo Lo Teitze. Then she does not get divorced. So here you have a circumstance or situation in which there was information brought to the attention of the Beit Din. The Beit Din gave a psak based on that information, and then new information came up after that fact. So now, when the new information came up, it now causes the Beit Din to have to retract their psak. So what Rabbi Nachum Rabbi Yossi says is, if nothing happened, if there was no action taken based on the psak Beit Din, we allow them to retract the psak, which is originally said, they had testimony that her husband passed away, so they said, go ahead and get married. All of a sudden, another set of Edim come along and say, he didn't die, he didn't pass away. So then the Beit Din retracts and says, you no longer can get married. And in a case where she hasn't acted on it, the Beit Din can retract it. On the other hand, when they gave psak halacha that she can marry based on the first set of Edim that said he passed away, then after she got married, two Edim show up and say, well, he's still alive, their Beit Din does not retract the original psak. What you see from Rabbi Nachum and Rabbi Yossi is that we worry about Ziluta de Beit Din. We worry about the reputation of the Beit Din. And we don't have the Beit Din retract their statement in a case where she acted on it already. So what you see is, once Beit Din has taken action, we do not retract it with the new testimony. So you, Rav Nachman, are suggesting over here, you took action, and now new testimony comes and you want to retract the action that you had before. Why is that the case? We worry about Zilut to the Beit Din. We do worry about Beit Din's reputation, and they're retracting their statements. So that is a strong proof to the fact that you cannot back out of a Psak Halacha and Beit Din when you have a Safek. Obviously, if the new evidence came that left us certain that the Psak needs to be changed, there we would change it. In this situation, the second testimony that comes out afterwards only serves to offset the first testimony. It's not decisive. The second testimony is not decisive to say they were completely wrong. All it does now is put into the realm of Safek. They gave Psak Halacha based on the first testimony. The new testimony is offsetting that first testimony, so now we're back to we don't know. So in a case where we don't know, we're not going to have Beit Din retract their position because of the reputation of Beit Din would be at risk for them changing their Psak Din. Everybody would laugh at it. I think it's a big joke that Beit Din changes their Psak. If you have clear evidence to the fact that they were wrong, then of course Beit Din has to change their position. But from here, what Rav Nachman said is incorrect, and therefore you would not be able to back out of what he had done before or how he acted before. Tosfot over here says he doesn't understand why the reputation of Beit Din is only subject when she got married. Once they give a Psak Halacha, why isn't the retraction of the Psak Halacha itself a loss of reputation for Beit Din? Why is it only when she acted on that Psak do we say that? So the Baal Yad Tosafot suggests over here that only when someone takes action based on the Psak Beit Din does it have that type of impact where people look at it as a joke when they reverse it. If they simply change the Psak Din before there's been any impact or any implications to it, people don't then get all worked up about it or think that Beit Din is playing around because nobody took any steps or any action based on that. And Tosafot explains that because in the case where they're just changing the Psak Din, they're changing the Psak Din, the Gabei, everyone. Until now, everyone was considered to be Mutar. And now they're changing the Psak Din to say that everyone is a sewer to this woman because of the change in evidence that is in front of us. On the other hand, in the case where they already married, then everybody else is a sewer in this woman and will remain a sewer in this woman. But for this particular individual who they permitted to marry this woman, now they're going to have to go in particular and reverse the psak with the gabay, this one individual. That's what creates or causes the problem of the ziluta debating, which is that they're going to have to change the psak, the gabay, someone in particular who they gave a heter to. If generically they're saying that the woman was mutar and now they're making a sur, that's one thing and that's not ziluta debating. But where someone took action and now they're going to change their psak, the gabay, this particular individual who had a heter, acted on the heter, and now they're going to make it a sur, that already is what generates the ziluta debate din. And that's why Tosafot says, you need a maaseh, not just simply a change in the psak din. But Tosafot says that there is a difference between simply changing the psak, or changing the psak after action has been taken, after someone has done something based on that psak. Given that, that's a much more significant change in attitude or position that we won't allow it. So I'm like, ana savar de mevad uvda, I wanted to act based on my thinking, which Rav Nachman said before was, now that we have offsetting evidence, I'm going to reverse the case. Hashta dotvinan at va'otvan Rav Amnuna b'Surya. Now that you have challenged my position, Rav who challenged Rav Nachman's position, as well as the fact that Rav Amnuna in Surya also challenged my position. We don't have any information about what happened or where this happened that Rav Amnuna did this, but the assumption is that he asked the same question that Rav asked from the Braita that was brought. Lo avdinen ba'uvda. I'm no longer going to be able to do anything. Nafak avaruvda. After that, he went ahead and did it anyway. So he says over here that what you're saying is true. Your point is well taken. The question you asked of me is valid. And therefore, I do have to worry about the reputation of Beit Din. Given that, I can't reverse my psak. Despite that fact, he walked out and reversed his psak. Manda chazer savar ta'uto hui biyadei. Those that saw him do it thought he made a mistake. After he was proven wrong, he still went ahead and did it, mistakenly. Velohi, that's not the truth. El mishom detalya ba'ashle rabavei. He hung his hat on the big guns. That's what Ashle Rabavei Rashi brings in different places. Sometimes he brings that it is a very tall tree, or it's the mast of the ship, or other times he brings that these are ropes, very, very thick ropes. But the meaning or the idea is the same, which is that he's hanging on to very strong people or big guns. What does that mean? Datnan. We have a Mishnah that brings Tanaic positions that seem to support Rav Nachman. which is Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ein Malin Likuna Al Pi Eid Echad. A single aid cannot come and testify as to the lineage or the yichus of a particular individual that he is a kohen. Amar Rabbi Elazar, Ematai. When is that true? B'makom sheish urin. When there are questions raised about this person's validity as a kohen. Ava makom shein urin. If nobody's questioning the validity of him as a kohen, malin lekula pi eid echad. Then a single aid would suffice to indicate that this person is a kohen. You can use a single aid, can testify, and therefore determine the yichus of this individual where's a kohen. The Gemara asks, Shimon Gamliel, Hainu Rabbi Elazar. Shimon Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar are saying the same thing. Rabbi Elazar says, we allow you to be malin api eid echad. And so does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel say the same thing, that eid echad works. Rabbi Yehuda says it doesn't work. Okay, so Yehuda's on the other side of the ledger. But both Rabbi Elazar and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel both agree that an eid echad works. If you want to suggest what's the difference between them, when there is a question that is raised about the yichus of this individual. Rabbi Elazar savar arar chad, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel savar arar trei. And their machloket is whether questioning or the challenge brought up. I mean that Rabbi Elazar believes, since one person already raised questions about this person's reputation, a single aid can't come now and override that or give this person yichus. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, arar trei, that you need two people to testify or challenge the validity or the kuhuna of this individual. But if it's only one person that's challenging it, the single aid would suffice to override it. It says, you can't say that. V'amar Rabbi Yochanan, divrei akol ein arar pachot mishnayim. Everybody agrees that arar, the minimum amount of people that need to raise questions about the yichus of an individual, are two. Ela arar trei. So it must be here that the questions about the reputation that were raised here were raised by two aidim. V'achamai skinan, g'gon d'machzikin elei ba'avua, da'ai koeinu. Problem or the question that arose is not about his yichus, but rather about how he came about. Which is that in order to be a kohen, obviously your father has to be a kohen. So there, they have that information and nobody's questioning that information. He is definitely the son of a kohen. That should automatically make him a kohen. The only problem is that who's his mother? Because if a kohen marries someone who is illegal or illicit for a kohen, then the child that is born is a kohen halal, and he does not gain the status of a kohen. So here, they're agreeing that he is a kohen from the sense of his father's side. Question is, his mother was a chalutza or grusha, which would then make him, yes, the son of a kohen, but a son of a kohen that is not a kohen. He's a halal, a kohen halal. So that's the question here. V'achtinei. So we know for certain that his father is a Kohen, but now rumors circulated or start to surface that he was a Ben Grusha Ben Chalutza. Based on that, the Beit Din said, you no longer can serve as a Kohen because of these rumors that are circulating. They removed him from the Kehuna. Va'at Eid Echad, and then a single Eid comes along and says, the Kohen who? That he is a Kohen. Va'askinei, and then they returned him to the Kehuna. Vata Beitrei, and then two Eidim come, Amri, the Ben Grusha v'chalutzahu, that he is a Ben Grusha v'chalutza, v'ach tinei, and then they removed him again. Vata Eid Echad v'amar, dekoenu, and then one more comes along and says that he is a Kohen. So we know for certain that his father is a Kohen, but now rumors circulated or start to surface that he was a Ben Grusha v'chalutza. Based on that, the Beit Din said, you no longer can serve as a Kohen because of these rumors that are circulating. Then an Eid Echad shows up and says, he is a Kohen and he's a fine Kohen. So Beit Din reinstated him as a Kohen. But then two Eidim showed up and said that he's a Ben Grusha or Ben Chalutza. So Beit Din once again deposed him and removed him from the Kehuna. Then after that, another Eid shows up and says, no, he's a fine Kohen. Now, the Kulei Alma Mitztarfim Edut. Everybody agrees that we join the Edut together. Because here you have two single Edim that are testifying. And therefore, when you aggregate their testimony, you have two Edim that are testifying to the validity of him as a Kohen. So So now what the Gemara says is that the two single edim that say he's a fine kohen, we join them together to become a single kat edim and say that he is a fine kohen. Now you have two versus two. Two saying that he's a fine kohen. Two saying that he's a ben grusha, ben chalutza. We're left bisafek. Based on that safek, what do we do now? At this point in time, he's been removed from the kuhuna. So the question is, do we reinstate him to the kuhuna based on that safek and return him to his former state or status? Because Beit Din has no reason to remove him now because they only have a safek, they have contradictory testimony. Do we reinstate him? But in that case, Beit Din would be upending or changing the psak they gave already. Or do we say, since Beit Din already removed him, and all we have now is a safek, they're not going to reinstate him based on that safek, because we worry about ziluta the Beit Din. And even though Beit Din already had removed him from the kuhuna, and reinstated him already, and we don't worry about ziluta there, that's because the original removal from the kuhuna was based on a call, based on a rumor. And therefore, it was really almost a suspension until they could further investigate. Once they investigated and they got this Eid Echad that said that he was a full-fledged Kohen, they were able to reinstate him as a Kohen because the rumors were proven to be improper. So over there, we don't worry about Ziluta the Beit Din because there was no Psak Beit Din. There was just a Chashash. There was a worry that these rumors are problematic. We need to investigate them. So we suspended him as a Kohen. Once we got more information, reinstate him as a Kohen. There's no issue of Ziluta the Beit Din. The Ziluta the Beit Din only is in the second part, where we have Edim testifying, and they paskin based on those Edim, that he should be removed from the kuhuna. And then now we get another aid who can join together with the first aid, and now we have two Edim that say he should be a kohen and should be reinstated. So now they would have to change the psak halacha. That's where the question of ziluta the Beit Din is relevant or raised. V'hacha b'meichash leziluta b'Beit Din ena kamiflegei. They're arguing about the reputation of Beit Din. And so now that would be the machlok between Rabbi Lazar and Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel. Rabbi Lazar savar kein dachtine lo maskinen lei. Since we already deposed him or we took him away from the kuhuna, we do not return him. Chashin and lizluta Beit Din. We worry about Beit Din's reputation. Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel savar anan achtine v'anan maskinen lei. We removed him. We will reinstate him. And we don't worry about the ziluta Beit Din. Therefore, they're machloket here about the ability to reinstate the Kohen based on the testimony of these two single Edim who joined together to make a full testimony. Do we worry about ziluta the Beit Din and say he remains Ois Kohen? Or do we say we don't worry about ziluta the Beit Din and we put him back and reinstate him as a Kohen? Because all we have here is a safek, and Beit Din has no reason to remove him at this point. And what Rav Nachman is saying is, I'm relying on this position of Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel, that given his position that we do not worry about the reputation of Beit Din, then I relied on that, and that's my position. Despite the fact that you brought questions on my position, I still paskin that way because I believe I'm right, and I have Tanaim that support my position, that we don't worry about ziluta de Beit Din. All right, we're going to stop here in the middle of Lamed Bet Amud Aleph. Tomorrow we'll go over the case here about the kuhuna again. To get into more details, I just wanted to stop in a place that made sense, which is, here is what brings Rav Nachman the support. We'll have to discuss in more details what exactly was the situation there about the son of the Kohen and the Ben Gushav and Chalutza, and then continue on to the questions that are asked in that case. But the conclusion that Rav wants us to realize is that Rav Nachman, despite the fact that he acknowledged Rava's question, but still went out and passed in that way, was not a mistake, but rather a reliance on these Tanaim that believe that that is the proper way to deal with these situations.